This is Hidden Killers Week in Review.
A look back at the most prolific stories of the week.
This is Hidden Killers Live with Tony Brewski, Stacey Cole, and Todd Michaels.
For decades, the Golden State Killer was the faceless terror of California, a ghost who broke into homes, stole innocence, and vanished. When he was finally caught, the courtroom became the one place where the survivors, after 40 years, could speak directly to the man who destroyed their lives. My guest today isn't just telling that story. He lived it. Sacramento County District Attorney Tin Ho led the prosecution that finally ended the Golden State Killer's reign of silence. And now in his new book, The People Versus the Golden State Killer, he's taking us behind the scenes of the investigation, the trial, and the moral weight of justice. And we're going to go into what went on behind those scenes, behind that curtain today, with your questions, our questions, and really digging deep into the parts of the story that you may have never heard before. Welcome to put your questions in the comments section there on YouTube, and we'll try to get to them throughout our conversation. Tin, welcome to the program, and thanks for taking the time today to join us.
It's an honor for me to be on the show, so thank you so much.
Tin, there's so much to go through and so many questions that I think a lot of us have about this case, where it's at today, how it got here. But I mean, take us back a little bit. I mean, you have lived, a very interesting story, the American immigrant story. You fled Saigon, learned English from scratch. You became the DA. I mean, I want to ask from your perspective, from your prism of everything you've lived through in life to coming into contact with this case, how did that experience and your experience shape the way that you saw this case about the power, the fear, and control that this man wielded for so many years?
You know, we're all a creation of our own history, right? Our personal history, our family's history. Yeah. And as you mentioned, I was born in Vietnam, and I escaped Vietnam after the fall of Saigon on a fishing boat. We ran out of gas, food, and water, drifting on the ocean until we were rescued, and I ended up in a refugee camp. And as you mentioned, when I came to this country as a child, I learned how to speak English by watching Bugs Bunny cartoons.
Oh, wow.
20 years later, graduated from law school. And the reason why I went to law school is I wanted to give back to the greatest country in the face of the earth with the greatest justice system. And so, you know, everything I've ever done in my career was try to give voice to the voiceless. And that's what we tried to do. That's what law enforcement tried to do in this very case. They could have given up 20, 30, 40 years ago, but the law enforcement officers kept pursuing him generation after generation. And then when we caught him, it was to help the victims find justice and find their voices and take that back from this monster who craved control because he had very little control and power in his own life.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about how was it? What was the situation where this began to enter your ether, where you first heard about the case, and then when you started being involved in the case, what was going on?
So I've been a prosecutor for 25 plus years, and I've been in Sacramento for 20, California's capital. And when I tried my first homicide in 2012, it was the murder of Rajneet Singh. Raj's body, half naked, was found on a January 1st in the drizzling rain behind a brick wall. And so when I was getting ready for trial, I went out to the crime scene with the lead detective and also my buddy from the office who was on the homicide team, Billy. He grew up in Rancho. And so as we're driving to the crime scene 2012, I see all these bars on every door and every window. I'm like, why are there so many bars everywhere in Rancho Cordova? Mm-hmm. And that's when they both said it's because of the ear. And I said, the ear? Who's the ear? In Sacramento, the ear means the East Area Rapist. And so my buddy Billy, who grew up there, says this was the boogeyman of our childhood. And he started talking about the crime and what this guy was doing and how he terrorized the community. And so that was in 2012. Fast forward 6 years later, we caught him and I was assigned the case. And I began to dig into all aspects of the case, his life and the victims as well.
When you look at it, how long this man had that reign of terror, and then went silent, but the remnants of the damage was done. For example, the bars on those windows, the stories that we've heard from the victims that, that were living with that, that constant fear for so many years, even after the silence, that impact was there, and nobody knew exactly what was going to happen next, if anything was going to happen next. When you got to kind of dig into the archives of all of this and the investigation over the years, what did you find? And I guess the big question I think a lot of people would have from an inside perspective would be, why? How did he evade? How did he evade being caught for all of that time? I mean, considering the massive trail of destruction that he left in his wake.
You're talking about 13 known murders, upwards of 50 sexual assaults, 120 burglaries in 11 different jurisdictions up and down the state of California over a 12-year time span. How did he evade capture? His scope was, the scope of his crimes was unfathomable. And how did he evade capture? I think two reasons. Number one was he was a police officer for most of the early part of his crime spree. So he knew about police tactics. He knew how long it would take for the police to arrive on scene, to set up their perimeters on the egress and egress. He knew all the ins and outs of how to escape, because he knew that where they would set up their blockade. And so he had an insider perspective and expertise on how to evade capture, how to identify his witness. But then the other problem was, back in the 70s and frankly into the 80s and even the 90s, a lot of the law enforcement agencies were siloed. You know, Sacramento didn't talk to Contra Costa. Contra Costa didn't talk to Santa Barbara or Orange County or these other jurisdictions. They were siloed. And so he was able to jump from jurisdiction to jurisdiction and evade capture. You know, in this day and age right now, if you were to commit this sort of crime, you would be caught, because we have forensic evidence and everybody has a Ring camera or surveillance videos or license plate readers. But this wasn't, you know, 2025. This is 1974, 1975, 1986.
Yeah. A very different time, very different place. And I agree with that. We talk about that quite a bit, I think, where today, I don't know that a lot of these predators of the past, at least in the way that they operated, could operate today because of technology, because of the way that we police things and the way that we can monitor things and the way that we can connect dots. That's if they were to operate under the same way that they had been operating. Mm-hmm. Do you think that there are any other people out there today like this that are operating but are more
tech savvy?
Tech savvy, are able to evade awareness the same way he did, based on the way technology was of that day, or is it just an impossibility in most cases for someone to be able to get away with things like he did in the time period that he did?
You can still have these sort of predators in this day and age. I see two categories. One is the truck driver, right? The one that goes from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, that's difficult to piece together. And the other one would be somebody that preys upon the people in our community, in our society, that are on the margins, right? That somebody may not be missing, whether they're a victim of human trafficking or drugs or living on the streets. And then nobody notices when they're gone because they're already gone. And then the other thing is, you have to literally commit a crime without your cell phone on you. The cell phone right now, even when you turn it off, it's pinging to the towers. Even if you don't have it on or in silent mode, it's constantly watching you, looking at you. You have to leave it somewhere else. And the other interesting thing is, if we zero in on you and you have this period of time where your cell phone is always in use, and then all of a sudden it's shut off, right? Or during the time period that you're committing the crime, that's a red flag.
Easily.
And we have technology right now where we call it basically a tower dump. Have you heard of a tower dump?
Yep.
Right? So a tower dump, for your listeners that don't know, is your phone is pinging off a tower. So let's say it's pinging off a tower that's 2 o'clock in the morning in the middle of nowhere, and a crime is occurring at that point. So we will do a tower dump of all the phones that are pinging off of that tower during that 1 hour around it. And any phone that's pinging off, because there are very few people in the area at 2 in the morning, that's our list of suspects. Now, it won't work if you're on I-5, you know, right next to the LAX airport, because there's so many people there, you know, at 7 o'clock in the morning. But that's just another tool we have. But you can get away with crime. It's just more difficult.
As a DA, are you surprised at the amount of criminals who are not tech literate, or I mean, they don't even have to be very tech literate, that still feel the need, that urge, that they still have to have their cell phone next to them while committing the crime, when that is what is likely going to get them caught in so many ways, or at least place them there? It seems to be such an obvious thing, but it seems there's so many cases where it's like, that's the one thing you forgot, that your cell phone is going to ping somewhere and tell us where you are.
You know, if you were smart, you wouldn't be committing crimes.
Sure.
Right.
And so, I mean, we're dealing with a subset of individuals here that are more likely to get caught because of it. And it's rare that you get somebody as meticulous, rare that you get somebody as smart, as detail oriented as the Golden State Killer.
Tan, was that a reason that you were able to zero in on him other than the DNA? Excuse me. Because it seemed like there was a pattern here, that this was a smart individual. He was evading capture. He was not being identified. Does law enforcement start looking inward, saying, you know, it could be one of us? And it takes me to the movie Speed. You know, like, it wasn't a retired cop who was doing this.
So, great question, by the way. They had done a series of profiles, at least two profiles, one of which was by the FBI. And the profile back in the 70s and the 80s determined or opined that he was a former cop or in the military, right? And lo and behold, he was in the military and he's a former cop with a criminal science degree. And in fact, the book starts off covering the Visalia Ransacker series. And that was a series of burglaries, 120 of them in a 3 mile square radius from 1974 to 1975, that culminated in the murder of Professor Claude Snelling in the attempted kidnapping of his 16-year-old daughter and the shooting of a police officer as well. But what came out from that was Officer McGowan was on a stakeout. And that evening, when they came face to face with each other, the ransacker, the Golden State Killer, Joseph D'Angelo, an officer, his mask was off. And so the officer was able to see the Visalia ransacker and said that his face looked familiar. Ooh. Well, at that time, Joseph D'Angelo was a police officer in a nearby town, and he had helped out on the task force to find the ransacker. And he was, in fact, the ransacker.
Wow.
And you can't make that stuff up, right?
No.
And the moment his face was seen, D'Angelo leaves that police force, moves up and becomes a police officer 30 minutes outside of Sacramento. And that's when the East Area Rapist crime spree happens up in Sacramento.
Because it was almost going to be kind of what I was going to ask you a question of, because you were talking about, you know, he has the knowledge of the police force behind him. And knowledge is one thing, but having the power of it is another. And that right there is a clear example of how he used the power of it to avoid being captured as the ransacker. Are there other examples in his story of terror over these years where it wasn't just the knowledge that he used to evade being captured, but the power to steer investigations or to steer people in a different direction other than him when they got too close?
There are plenty of examples of that during his East Area Rapist crime spree. He had a particular MO. He would break into the home. Well, first of all, let me take a step back. His first crimes in Sacramento, when he was committing the sexual assault, often involved just one person at home, a single female. And so the PIO, the public information officer for the sheriff's department, says, oh, he's targeting single women living at home. Immediately, he switches his MO, and he starts targeting husband and wives couples. So he would break in about 1 o'clock in the morning with a husband and wife in bed. He shine a flashlight on them with a gun. He says, freeze, don't move. I'm just here for drugs and money. I live in a van down by the river. I'll be gone. So he gave that story of a, a drug addict. And he would sometimes act like a drug addict, right? Where's the drugs? Where are the drugs? To throw the scent off of him. And so what he'll do is he'll do that. He'll throw the pre-tied shoelaces to the wife to tie up the husband. Then he would tie up the wife. He would go through the house. He'd eat their food, drink their beer. He would ransack the house. And then eventually he would come back and separate the wife from the husband. He would sexually assault her. He would lay blankets on top of the husband, who was forced on all fours, and told the husband, and stacked plates and bottles, and said, if I hear anything fall or break, I'll kill everybody in the family. And then sometimes he would start talking to himself as if there was somebody else in the room. So he did things like that to sprinkle little pieces of different information to throw people off his track. The other thing that he did was he would scope out the area extensively beforehand. He would oftentimes break into that home that he targeted a couple of days before, leave an item in the seat cushion and come back to see if they found it or take something. So he was the ultimate predator of human beings, watching, stalking them before he actually committed his crimes.
Was it... When you look at this and you try to psychologically evaluate what the hell's going on here, the psychological torture, the mental torture, and then his phone calls, too, that he would make after the fact with some of these victims, just to continue to torture them. Ultimately, obviously, that is about control for a predator. But it is so dark. And so many move on to their next victim, unless they're going to keep going back to the same. But what do you think, when you try to put yourself in the shoes of a monster like this, what is his goal? Is it just to instill fear? Is it ultimately just the darkest form of control that one can have, and that's how he fed?
Tony, that's a great question. You know, I have a chapter in the book called The Monster Behind the Mask. Right. And so when I got the case, one of the first things we did was we decided to try to recreate every aspect of his life, you know, from when he was born in Bath, New York, to when he was arrested and put in jail. And even when he was in jail, we were watching him. But what it was he felt very little control and power in his own life. And because of that, he had to exert that over other people. So when he was a child, when he was a young boy, he witnessed his little sister being raped on a military base by two service members. And he was tied down and held down during that process. He was beaten by his parents. I mean, the fact of the matter is these things happened to him. And so now when he grew up, he became a police officer. And he felt as if the law didn't apply to him. It was his way of exerting, as a police officer, control over other people when he didn't have it. The other thing was, a number of the victims said that he had an extremely small penis and a micro penis. And so when I got the case, what we did was we went, executed a search warrant and took photos of his genitalia, and they were extremely small. And so he felt very powerless in his own life in so many different ways that now he's playing God, because he would tie people up. He would drink their beer, eat their food. And when he left, after sexually assaulting and violating their relationship and marriage, he'd take one earring and leave the other one behind as a reminder. He'd take the wedding band. And so these were his forms of control. And then when he was in Southern California, he killed all the witnesses, but you can see there he's holding their lives in his hand as he is about to pull the blanket over their head and bludgeon them to death with a log or a brass sprinkler head. And so he was playing God. And that's what he wanted to do, was to get some of that control. Now, regardless of what made a monster, he is still a monster that needs to be held accountable.
Sure. Yeah, I mean, it's basically the recipe. And the recipe, you know, it is the end result. It doesn't excuse what's made out of that recipe, but it starts to make a lot more sense psychologically as to how you can get somebody like this. What did you discover about his life while he was doing this? He was a father. He had been married. I know he did get divorced at some point. But what was life like, you know, with the kids on the normal side of things, where nobody had any clue that this was this monster hiding behind the facade of a father and a police officer?
So for 99% of his known crimes, they were committed before he became a father.
Mm-hmm.
And he was married and in a relationship with his wife for a significant portion, or for all of the portion of the known crimes. But the fact of the matter is, when we started digging into his marriage and his family life, he lived a very separate life under the same roof from his wife. She was going to law school at first, and then she became a lawyer. He was a police officer, and then he was a mechanic, unemployed for a period of time after he was fired as a police officer for shoplifting a hammer and dog repellent. But they lived separate lives, separate schedule. And I honestly believe that his wife, who is fairly absorbed in her own life and her own person, mm-hmm. did not know that he was the East Era rapist, the original sure. Night Stalker and the Golden State Killer. But he was prolific. He was a police officer by day and a serial killer and serial rapist by night. I don't think he ever slept.
Wow. And that had to make him a little bit even more unstable, that lifestyle, just feeding into that frenzy.
Absolutely. But the seeds of that started much earlier. You know, I covered a portion of his teenage years, and there's a little piece of evidence, a fact, a story in the book that has never been revealed before. And it just shows you his depravity. At one point when he was around the age of 17, he used to collect, it's gross, but he would carry around a jar full of women's pubic hair. I mean, that's how weird and sick he was, right, as a teenager. And he was showing that off as a trophy, right? And that's why whenever he committed his crime, he always took a trophy. But his sexual depravity didn't end even when he became an old man after he was arrested. I have video of him in his jail cell when he was 73 years old, and he's standing there. There's this young, blonde, female worker who was delivering food in the pod area, and he's standing there looking at her, leering at her, and he begins to masturbate to her. So even at the age of 73, he had not lost the sexual depravity that drove him when he was much younger.
Wow.
Jesus. All because of a micro penis. That's what it comes down to, it seems like, in this. Like, it's because of that insane insecurity that turned into, wow, and then a very, very broken brain. So many questions about a lot of that, but we can move forward. The way that he seemed to be almost a chameleon, it sounds like, in a lot of his life, where he could be a cop, then he could be a mechanic, and then he could be a loving dad. We learned before the show, Stacey, you were looking up information about the daughters, and the daughters had said loving father, right? I mean,
the best father you could ever have is what one of them said.
And obviously we know in the greater context of things, what a monster he was, but it's such a stark contrast to how he could be a different human being to different people. And that really starts to make you wonder, gosh, what kind of a depth can this be? And then we saw the version of him in court as well. I know in the book you had mentioned that you believe he was trying to fake insanity while obviously that was part of the defense, but also when he was in court, when we saw those images of him, those videos of him, he looks like this frail old man that's mm-hmm. barely present. All an act, you say. Tell me about what you witnessed in that scope of things.
He is the master manipulator. He has manipulated everybody in his inner circle and outer circle. A couple hours before he was arrested, we had a surveillance team following him, and he was out there jumping in and out of his boat. A few days before that, he was on his motorcycle at the age of 72, weaving in and out of traffic, going 80 miles an hour, doing counter surveillance moves. And suddenly we arrest him, and he's sitting there almost as if he is in a comatose state in the interrogation room. They wheel him into the courtroom, And he's in a wheelchair, laid back with his mouth ajar, breathing out of his mouth like a fish, you know, on the ground. And it was all an act, because literally, as he's doing that in the courtroom, I have video of him walking into his cell with a cane, okay? Have you guys ever seen the movie The Usual Suspects?
Mm-hmm. Right? Yes.
And that scene where he's walking out of the police station. So I have a video of D'Angelo, the Golden State Killer, hobbling in, barely limping as he's walking in with a cane to a cell. The moment the door closes, the cane goes down. He's doing jumping jacks. He's moving around. He's climbing up and down his, you know, his bunk bed. He is the master manipulator. He's been that way his entire life. The people that really, really know him see the monster behind the mask. And so that's who he is. And the only time that we really get a glimpse of him is in those quiet moments when he's in his cell thinking that he's alone and nobody's watching. I mean, I had videos of him. Literally, he would walk in a triangle for like 2 hours straight, 18 steps, nearly every footstep in the same spot. Just methodical, like an animal cage that's ready to pounce.
It sounds like just animal instincts on a monster like this. Yeah. We're talking with Tin Ho. He's the author of The People versus the Golden State Killer, and also the DA who helped prosecute the Golden State Killer several years back. I want to ask, because I think a lot of people are wondering. I was wondering, because it's been a few years since I've done anything on the case. Obviously, a lot of it has wrapped up and he's in his cage. But as we were just talking, he looked so frail and so fragile in court. We've now obviously learned that was all an act. A few years later now, he's 79 years old, I believe. Mm-hmm. What can you reveal about what this guy is like today in prison?
So he received multiple life without the possibility of parole sentences. And so he's not getting out of prison. So he's in mm-hmm. prison down in the Central Valley. He's in what we call the Protective Needs Unit. That unit has other child molesters and rapists and snitches. And they're separated together because if you put them in GPOP or general population, they're going to get killed. Mm-hmm. Dahmer was killed because he was a sexual predator. And those sexual predators are not kindly looked upon in prison. Plus, if you can kill somebody like a Golden State Killer or a Jeffrey Dahmer, you're going to gain notoriety. So they put him in this protective needs unit. He works in the mess hall, in the cafeteria. But what I do know, and what I have been told, is that he is constantly looking over his shoulder, worried and terrified that somebody's going to attack him. And that is, frankly, the right thing. I was very thrilled when I heard that, because he made people feel that way in their lives. And so it's about time that he lives and gets to feel his own living hell.
Are there people who have access to him that could harm him, even though he is protected?
And can we fill their canteen as an incentive?
Well, but my question is, you know, he's protected and he's looking over his shoulder. Who is he looking at?
He's looking at everybody. I mean, you don't know where that attack's going to come from. Now, he happens to be in there with other child molesters and other rapists that are looking over their shoulders. But there are also people that are snitches and gang dropout people that probably don't even like him. So, you know, the former gang members, they detest rapists and child molesters. And that's exactly who he is. So could he be attacked? Absolutely. And that's probably why he's looking over his shoulder. Rightfully so.
When the victims were giving their impact statements, and I want to say this about your book, it is very victim focused. It's not so much the life story of the Golden State Killer. We've already heard that a gazillion times. This is really getting into the victims themselves, their lives, how it's affected them, and it's a very, very real and raw look at the damage and that this monster caused. I want to ask, when they were giving their victim impact statements to him in court, And he was sitting there looking like a decrepit zombie. What was that like for you? What was that like for the victims? One on the outside who wouldn't necessarily know how much of a chameleon he was. us just kind of watching from a distance, I think a lot of us thought, is he even hearing them? Like, is anything even registering? Do you think he heard what they were saying? And if so, how do you think that was bouncing off of his mind? I know he did make a short statement there, but in your opinion, from what you saw and you felt being in there, what was that like?
I can tell you that sitting there 6 feet away from him and listening to victim after victim walk up and talk about the impact that his crimes had on their lives, it was very emotionally draining. At the end of the day, I'd just sit down and just kind of close my eyes and just take in a lot of deep breaths because it was just so emotional, impactful. It's like every person that came up there, every story, it just tore at the very fabric of your heart. And I will never forget, there were two. The first was the impact statement given by Gay Hardwick. She was home with her husband. And she talked about how there's this, she brought up this piece of paper. And it was a piece of paper that was all crumpled up. And she says that this piece of paper is me. It's crumpled up. It's no longer, it represented my life and it's been crumpled up and torn apart and stomped upon. And even when you pull it apart, it's still all wrinkled. And then she brought up a clean sheet of paper and said, this is what my life would have been before you. And I know that you witnessed and you saw these horrible things happen to your sister, but you did these things to me and I didn't turn out to be a monster. And she talked about how she was on her way to being an executive, very successful. And then she locked herself in her house afterwards. And eventually she came out of her house and she picked a career of teaching little kids, toddlers, because she knew that those kids couldn't hurt her. That's how much of an impact it had on her. And then I was watching him and he was sitting there with his mask on because we're in the middle of COVID and he's just looking straight ahead with that zombie look. But there was one moment. Jane Carson, she was one of the early victims. She was a nurse. She was in the military. She left the military eventually as a colonel. She wrote a book, Frozen in Fear. So she's fire and brimstone. And when she gave her impact statement, he says that, you know, I've brought somebody here with me today, somebody that is also a victim. That person is Bonnie. And she brought Bonnie up. Now, for those who are familiar with the case, Joseph DeAngelo was engaged to a woman named Bonnie, and she called off the engagement. And years later, when he was committing one of his rapes in Davis, California, he was sitting there rocking back and forth and crying and saying, I hate you, Bonnie. Now, there have been people, and I think that it's misplaced and it's wrong, that has blamed Bonnie for him committing these crimes. No, that is downright wrong to blame Bonnie. Yeah. These crimes lay at the feet of Joseph DeAngelo and Joseph DeAngelo only. But from the time that Bonnie basically, you know, ended that relationship, that engagement, DeAngelo had not seen her for 40-something years. And so Jane brought her to the courtroom to stand right there.
The Bonnie, not just a Bonnie. Random Bonnie, but no. The Bonnie.
Just a Bonnie the she Bonnie. Met at Kmart.
No, but like it was her. It was genuinely her.
It was Bonnie. It was her. Brought her right there. And Bonnie is standing there 6 feet looking at him. And Jane's just laying into him, calling him the word, you know, addressing him directly and just laying into him. And Bonnie's right there. And so I immediately look over to DeAngelo. And even though he had a mask on and he's sitting there, his breathing literally stopped when Bonnie came up. And then he started to breathe again, but it was really shallow and he had a gulp. And so Jane wanted to get a reaction out of him.
Good.
And Jane got a reaction out of him. It was awesome.
Why do you think that was, that Bonnie is the thing that got a reaction out of him? And what else could get a reaction out of him? In a comparison I'll make is the Koberger sentencing, which just took place, where, you know, just stood there stone faced. But when Olivia Gonsalves got up there and went into him, there was a lot of people who were sitting around going, that seemed to be the time that Koberger had some sort of a reaction, that he had some sort of fear going on in him. It was because she was going after very specific aspects of his personality, his intelligence, the things that he thought he was very good at. And when she was attacking all of those things, that's what seemed to trigger him. Folks like this seem to have some sort of a trigger, something. And just saying you're a horrible person, you're a monster, you're a blah, 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 that usually doesn't affect them very much. They already know that. They've accepted that. They take pride in that in some cases. How did having Bonnie there, and why did having Bonnie there get some sort of reaction out of him? And are there any other areas of life that would trigger this man to feel something or to trigger that anger, that whatever emotion it would be in a monster like this, that is recognition of something that they don't want to face?
But Kohlberger, as you may recall, was a criminal justice major, right?
Yep. Yep.
And D'Angelo was a criminal justice major. You know, they were both attracted because they wanted this element of control. Mm-hmm. They wanted the inside knowledge. And it comes back to control. He did not have control over Bonnie. But he tried to have control. And I cover that relationship in the book. He tried to have control over Bonnie and get her to do certain things. And she wouldn't do it. And that's what ultimately ended that relationship. That she ended up taking away the control from him, Bonnie mm-hmm. did. And here was a victim, Jane Carson, who took control back and away from him. And not only did she do that, she brought somebody else who had yeah. done that, who he had not seen for so long. So what he wanted most in life was control. And he gets to sit there and control himself and be in that zombie state. He gets to sit there and like hold himself a certain way, portray himself a certain way. But when somebody else comes in and pierces that control, that's what gets to him.
What a beautiful moment.
Did you get a chance to talk to Bonnie? Did you have any interactions with her to hear what life is like for her? That's got to be a weird juxtaposition of life to look back on and go, that was almost the person I was going to marry. But I changed all that. And she made the choice to get away from that. What do we know about how life has been for her and how she's processed this?
So Bonnie, you know, obviously when we arrested him, we dug into his history, found Bonnie. So we interviewed Bonnie multiple times to get really an image of D'Angelo, the Golden State Killer. I've talked to Bonnie a couple of times as well. I mean, immediately after court, I ran into Bonnie and Jane. Mm-hmm. I ran into Bonnie and Jane, and we were talking outside. We took a picture together as well before I wrote the book. While I wrote the book, you know, I reached out and talked to Bonnie as well. She is a powerful personality. She has also right now trying to help out some of the survivors. You know, she's part of a group of the survivors group to really help other survivors as well. She's part of a group that started by Chris Pedretti. Chris is one of the other survivors, Chris and Gay. So I cover a few of the stories in the book. And so they started a nonprofit called Phyllis's Garden, which supports other survivors. And so part of the proceeds of this book goes to support Phyllis's Garden so that we can support survivors. So many of the survivors have found their voices and have turned pain into power.
Tan, how has this case coming into your life, how has it changed you as a person? Because you don't walk away from this unscathed either, I imagine.
You know, as prosecutors, we see people at the worst moment in their lives, right? Either they are a victim and they've had the very tapestry of their life shredded, they are or lost a loved one, or they are a defendant and now they're facing life in prison. We see people in the darkest moments. It's never good when you come and see a prosecutor, right? And like first responders and like the police, we take in a lot of the sins of the world. You know, I wrote about in the book, the sin eaters. The sin eaters in England, they're hired to come to funerals and they eat a piece of bread almost to represent that sin, not to absolve somebody of the sin, but to help them move on to the afterlife. You know, and so these cases, they stay with you. It's hard to take in the darkness. I can't turn on the switch on and off my mind. I don't sleep very much. You know, this was the last case I handled. and but it still stays with me. But the way it's affected me is this. It has reinforced my belief in regards to the resiliency of the human spirit, that you could have the most horrible things happen to you and you could come out on the other side hurt, pained by it, but then turn that tragedy into triumph like so many of the survivors have. And the other thing it reminds me is this is justice never sleeps. It never forgets. Sooner or later, we will find you and we will bring you to justice. And even if you are dead, we will bring your name into the light of day. We will drag it into the sunlight to show the world the monster that you were. And those are the two constants that I keep with me, is that the eternity of justice and the resiliency of the human spirit.
Speaking of that, genetic genealogy also doesn't forget. And that's part of what brought that's one of the big things that brought the Golden State Killer to light was just that. How many other cases do you think are out there? How many are you aware of in your own ecosystem where you're like, if we could start cracking the code on this a little bit, get some investigators reopening some cases using IgG to do essentially what they did here and in so many other cases of tracking folks down. Do you think that there is going to be a massive resurgence in old cases now that this technology just keeps getting better and better of unearthing crimes that many thought either, you know, went to people with the grave or that they just thought they got away with for 40, 50 years?
So my office pioneered the use of investigative genetic genealogy to solve this case. And right now, and we teach across the country on how to use that technique. We develop best practices. And I can tell you that there's been over 1,000 cold cases that have been solved since the Golden State Killer, from child molestation to rape cases to murders using IgG. And we continue to do it. So after I was elected district attorney, I started a cold case science and technology unit where we're going over cold cases right now to solve them. The other thing that I've started as well is I created a task force to look into the MMIP crisis. So MMIP stands for Murdered, Missing, and Indigenous People. Indigenous women are 10 times more likely to be murdered than their counterpart in the general population. And many of these cases go uninvestigated and unsolved. And there's nothing but silence left for our Native people and those families. So I started a task force working with the Sheriff's Department and a local tribe to really look into these cases. So we're trying to use this to solve so many different other cases and bring justice. And the technique that Paul Hoves came up with on here and that we perfected has solved cases and brought justice to families.
Let me ask you this about IgG, and maybe kind of an idea, too. Obviously, somewhat we're at the mercy of if you go and do the test, take the test, volunteer for the test. A lot of times it's, you know, you've got it as a gift or you decided, I'm curious, I'm going to go sign up for Ancestry or 23andMe or whatever it may be. And then it gets into the database. Has anyone ever thought of offering IgG tests just on an open basis for anyone who may be sitting here going, you know, I suspect my uncle might have been this person or might have done this, but maybe they don't have the means or they don't want, you know, to go spend the $100 on the test and then get that information to the database. And I know you don't technically need to be like that close, but I'm wondering if there was a way to encourage more people to get their information into the database under that sort of a thinking of, I don't care if I'm exposing a horrible human being, and I just don't have the means to get that information out there. Does anything like that exist for folks who are thinking, hey, take my DNA and see what kind of monsters are in my bloodline, basically?
I think that's a really interesting idea in terms of doing it. You know, obviously we have to get the funds together to help people do it for free. Right now we are investigating a cold case murder. And we have narrowed down the family tree to this one family in the Midwest. And we have been in contact with that family because we need somebody in that family that we think is related to them to upload their DNA. So we sent them a kit. We paid for it. We're trying to help them go through the process of uploading that information into the database so we can figure it out. So we will work with individuals that we believe is a relative of the killer, because there are certain common ancestors that from there you can figure out what branch of that family tree the killer resides in.
I love that. I just wonder if there was, I mean, obviously funding is a big thing with that. I just wonder if there was more opportunities for people to upload their DNA if they wanted to and they weren't held back by financial means. How many more pieces to the puzzle investigators would get to help solve some of these crimes if that's an availability, if that's a resource that they could take up. I don't know. I'm very fascinated by it. I always wonder, a joke I always make is, you know, if you really want to, if you're wondering about your own family and you have a get together, whether it be Christmas or whatever, get everybody a DNA kit and see which family member is off in the corner like, I'm good. I don't need one of those. That may tell you all you need to know.
Might be a red flag.
Exactly. Might be a slight red flag there. It's a fascinating book, The People versus the Golden State Killer, Tin Ho. It's available November 11th, correct?
Yes. Yes.
Wherever November books 11th. Are sold. Yes. Go check it out. It's such a fascinating story and a chapter of this story, if you've been following it, that you've not heard before from a perspective you've not heard before. Tin, thank you so much for coming on and sharing your experiences in all this with us.
No, I really appreciate it. You know, as I've said before, this is the third book in the trilogy. You had Michelle McNamara's book, Paul Holes, who did the investigation, but this covers the investigation, the capture, and the prosecution. And it's been an honor to be on the show. I love the conversation. Thank you.
Thank you
so much. Your thoughts in the comments section, everybody. Until next time, for Stacey and Todd, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.